The Pesukim are very descriptive in terms of how the Jewish nation should relate to the other peoples. Some Gentile nations who convert are immediately accepted, some are never accepted, and some are accepted conditionally. The Pesukim of Devarim tells us, Lo tzitayev adomi, do not totally push away the adomi, ki achichuhu, lo tzitayev mitzri, don't push away the mitzri, ki ger ha'yisa ba'artzo, because you were a foreigner in his land, you lived in his land. So the pasuk is very clear that our relationship to the mitzri is sort of mixed. Don't totally push him away. Why shouldn't you totally push him away? Because ger ha'yisa, you live there. He gave you a place to live, he gave you a place to exist, therefore don't totally push him away. Now, Rashi is bothered by the problem that doesn't sound very appropriate. If the pasuk wants to tell me that you should have a karas hatov, you should recognize the good, then it sounds to be a very poor way of expressing it. We lived in Mitzrayim for 210 years. If we're supposed to recognize the fact that they gave us a place for 210 years, don't tell me don't push them away. Tell me welcome them, bring them into your mitzvah, accept the mitzvah, because you owe them a tremendous debt of gratitude. Yet that's not what the pasuk is saying. The pasuk is saying don't totally push them away because you lived in their land. Rashi, being bothered by that problem, explains the answer to this. He says, Mikol v'kol, don't totally push them away. Afal pi shezarchu zechrayim liyor, even though they threw your male children into the Nile, still you can't totally push them away. Matam sheyolech machsanya b'shasatchak. Because the reality is that you did have a place to live, despite it being difficult, you had a place to live. So says Rashi as follows. We do have a debt of gratitude. Why? Because we live there. However, that debt of gratitude is tempered because they were torturous to us. They threw our firstborn in the Nile. Therefore, the Torah's middle ground is, well, kind of, don't push them away totally. And that's how Rashi answers the problem. Now, if you think of this Rashi, I think it's very, very difficult to understand. Let's focus for a minute on what it was like to be a Jew in Mitzrayim. It was not a walk in the park. It was a very, very austere, very, very difficult existence. And we were tortured, we were bled, we were oppressed, we were enslaved. But more than anything, if you want to really understand the position, why was it so difficult for Paro to let the Jewish people out? It had little to do with political power, little to do with honor. It had to do with the fact that Mitzrayim was a slave economy and we were the slaves. What that means in plain language is that the only reason the Mitzrayim gave us food to eat so that we should work, the only reason they gave us a place to sleep is so they could use our bodies to build their pyramids. They didn't do us a single favor. There was nothing that they did for us. It was strictly a business deal. They provided us a place to live because we were their slaves. It was totally against our will. And if you focus on the fact that they were not very kindly taskmasters, you quickly understand that this Rashi is very difficult to understand. As a minor illustration, the Medrash tells us that Paro had saras. His wise men told him the solution to his problem was to bathe in human blood. I guess baby's blood is more pure than adult's blood. Therefore, in the morning he had 150 Jewish babies slaughtered. Heaven forfend for him to bathe in the evening in the same blood that he bathed in the morning. Therefore, morning and night he slaughtered wholesale 150 children. So let's put this into perspective. We're enslaved in this country. Everything that they provided to us is only for their good. They're torturing us, they're oppressing us, they're wicked beyond description. But says Rashi, well, still, you have to have a karas hatov, you must recognize the good, because they gave you a place to sleep. They gave you a place to live. They only gave us that place to live for their good. They did it against our will. They were wicked during it. What possible karas hatov, what possible recognition of the good should we have to them? Clearly, we should be absolved of any responsibility, and we should throw them completely, totally away. The question is, what's pshat in this Rashi? And to answer this question, I'd like to share with you a fundamental concept that the Cholos of Lvov says. He has a question. His question is, why is it that every human being doesn't perceive the good that they have? He says that by all rights, every human being should recognize that we live an enchanted, rich life, And every human being should have an unending sense of recognition of how wealthy they are, how good they have it. And he says there are a number of reasons why the human being doesn't reach that clear recognition. And I'd like to share with you this evening two of them. And the first reason he explains why a human being doesn't recognize the good that he enjoys in this world is what he explains with a mushroom. Imagine that there are two teenagers, two brothers who are having a conversation. They live in a beautiful mansion, a fantastic estate, and they have every one of their needs, everything imaginable provided for them. These two brothers are having a conversation. One of them turns to his brother and says, "Wow, our father is so generous. Everything he does is for our good. Everything he is concerned with is only us. He's such a magnificent, generous individual." His brother turns back to him and says, "Well, I don't know about that. All this stuff about getting up early in the morning, this stuff about your education is going to make you into who you're going to be, this running 5 miles a day, I don't know. I think the old geezer is into it for his own good. I don't think he really cares about us much at all." Says the Chovos Levavos, what's the difference between the two brothers? One is adopted. Meaning, the one who is adopted knows what it's like to live without. The one who is adopted understands what it's like not to have food, what it's like not to have a house. When that man generously took him into his estate, the adopted son has a tremendous sense of recognizing the good because for a long time he didn't have it. And because he didn't have it and he now is presented with it, he feels such an unending, uncompromised sense of recognition of the good. He feels so grateful, hence he sings the praises of that man. Whereas the naturally born son does not feel that at all, because from the time he opened his eyes, all he saw was wealth and opulence. And says the Chovos Levavos, that is the first reason why it's so difficult for us to recognize the good. Since the time we are very, very little, since the time we first opened our eyes, everything in this world has been there. Sights, colors, depth, all of the experience of the human being has been there since we were born. Hence we become so accustomed to it that it long ago lost its wonder. We don't appreciate it. It's bland and it doesn't move us. And the Chovos Levavos explains that the very first goal of a person to become appreciative is to recognize his wealth. Recognize his wealth means do a very basic inventory. The reality is, I have eyes with which to see, hands with which to feel, legs with which to walk. The brachas we say in the morning are supposed to be said with a tremendous outpouring of emotion. We're supposed to have a tremendous sense of, wow, look what I enjoy. We're supposed to look out at a beautiful scene and see it and say, that's magnificent, that's wondrous. The difficulty is because we've always seen it, we've always been there, and it doesn't move us. But you have to train yourself, you have to work on yourself to reignite that wonder, that excitement, and to feel that sense of awe and majesty when you look at a beautiful scene, and to appreciate the fact that I have eyes, that's a wondrous gift, hands are a wondrous gift, and sense of sight, sense of smell, all of these are tremendous gifts. Now, if you have been listening to the Shmooze for any length of time, you've heard this already. And most likely, you're saying to yourself, well, yeah, I know that. And I'm pretty good at this stuff. This Hakaras HaTov stuff, I don't really have much to work. And I'm pretty good at this sort of stuff. My friends, I should bring down for them to hear it. But this, I'm pretty good at. I'd like to share with you a very simple exercise. If you think that you're doing pretty good at this thing called recognizing the good, here's a very simple question that you have to answer. The very simple question is, are you rich? Are you rich? Are you rich? Not a hard question to answer. The answer is no. And it really doesn't matter how much money you have. Ask anybody you know, are you rich? I almost guarantee the answer is no. And I'd like to share with you why the answer is no. You see, most people define are you rich with a very simple criteria. Rich means I have more than you. So if I have more than you, I'm richer than you. But if I have only just as much as you do, and surely if I have less than you, I'm not rich. How could you call me rich? So, according to that definition, I'd like to share with you a very interesting fact. Would you like to know who should be the most miserable human being on the face of the planet? the single most miserable human being on the face of the planet should be Warren Buffett. Why? Because for 7 years in a row, he was the second richest man in the world. Oh, second richest man. What could be worse than that? And my $37 billion are worthless. Why? Because Bill Gates beat me again. I'm only the second wealthiest man in the world. And the definition of rich is the richest. And I'm not there yet. And by the way, Bill Gates slipped 1 year. He gets zooks. Is nothing sacred? And you see, gentlemen, that's the point. If the definition of rich is richer than you, then you're destined to be poor for your entire existence. Because A, it's unlikely that you'll be the richest guy in the world. And even if you are, somebody's going to beat you out. And that is a very, very sad state of affairs. And I'd like to share with you the correct definition of rich. And rich means you have. Surely if you have more than what you need. Rich is not based on me compared to you. Rich is based on one single issue. Do I have my needs met? Do I have abundance? Do I have things? Material possessions? And if the answer is yes, then I'm very, very rich. Even if you also have it. Even if I live in a rich society. Even if I live in a rich world where everyone drives cars, where everyone owns homes, where everyone turns on the heat and it's hot. Even if everyone has it, that doesn't stop me from being rich. And if you need a little mussar, we'll review one of the very early shmuzim. Just go back a few hundred years and compare yourself to earlier generations and ask yourself if you're not rich. Compare yourself to the kings of England who used to walk dank, smelly hallways in poorly lit, poorly heated estates called Buckingham Palace, where they could not get the basic comforts that we take as a given. The average taxpaying citizen in our society enjoys riches and luxuries that kings of yesteryear could not imagine. And yet there's not a person you'll meet who will say to you, "Bepemole, I'm rich." Why? Because again, the definition that most people use for rich is false. And once you begin getting the correct definition of rich, which is I have my needs met, I have what I need, and I enjoy things, then in fact you'll understand that you're very, very wealthy. But it requires exercise, it requires thinking, it requires dwelling upon it, and it requires thinking about how wealthy you are. And that's the first problem that comes in terms of understanding and learning to be happy. The first problem that we have is that we're totally accustomed to it. We're born into this very, very wealthy world. We're born into a world of sights and smells and flavors and textures, and we fail to recognize it because we're like that spoiled teenager. And even if we begin exercising some das, some thought, we're quickly assailed by the definition of rich that everyone else uses, which is, I can't be rich if others have more. If everyone has a car, if everyone has a house, it doesn't make me rich. And that's patently false. But there's one more element that you need to focus on if you'd like to really enjoy your stay in this world. And that is that any good that you'll ever enjoy in this world is going to be a mixed blessing. No matter how good you have it, and this world is not the place of reward. This world is the place of working. And every pleasure, every riches, everything that you have in this world is going to be a mixed blessing. But the fact that it's a mixed blessing doesn't stop it from being a blessing. And it's rather ironic to hear the way people describe things. My wife, she's this and this, but she... And then the list starts. And very quickly, if you listen to the way people speak, and they quickly forget about all of the good and quickly harp on the bad. My car is great, but. My house is great, but. And learning to be sophisticated means learning to understand I could have a tremendously good thing. My wife can be tremendous, 90% of the way perfect, and 10% not. Learning that one doesn't cancel out the other. My wife is someone who I appreciate, who does so much for me, and there are things that I don't like, but I still am able to appreciate that which she does for me. My house is fantastic. I love it. The things about it that aren't good, but one doesn't cancel out the other. The fact is that very few people are able to do that. I think what Rashi is teaching us is a tremendous yesod. You see, what the Mitzrim did for us was basically nothing. They did it for them. But at the end of the day, there are two issues that have to come to bear. His intention and what I received. What the Mitzrim intended was strictly a business deal, totally in their interest. They wanted to support the Jewish slaves because they were a source of labor for them. They had not an iota of our benefit in mind, strictly for their good. But the reality is we received. We had a place to live, food to eat. For 210 years, the Jewish nation existed there. And therefore, Rashi is teaching us, we have to recognize that good. You see, my friends, this is the great, great yesod. Every one of us is very grateful. We're naturally grateful, perfectly grateful. We're the most grateful people you'd ever imagine. The problem is, I have nothing to be grateful for. You see, I'd be the first person to thank Hashem if I had anything, but my life stinks. If I were given anything, if there was anything in the world for me to be thankful for, I'd be the most appreciative person in the world, but there's nothing for me to thank Hashem for. And you see, our problem is not that we're not grateful. We're very, very grateful, but we're not appreciative. Appreciative means we don't value that which we have. And we have tremendous, tremendous blessings, tremendous, tremendous good. And the reason that we don't feel any sense of gratitude is because we don't see the blessings for what they are. We can have the magnificent gifts of freedom, the magnificent gift of being alive, the magnificent gift of sight, of being able to sit down to a meal, have children, bring up my children the way that I want, and we look at it and say, my life, what do I got? I got nothing. And if you talk to people from two generations ago, and you describe the fact that you have freedom, and bring up your children exactly as you want, teach them as you want, earn a living easily and have a place to live, they look at you like, wow, you're the richest guy in the world. And one of the great yesods of being a true Eved Hashem is not learning to be grateful. That comes natural. It's learning to appreciate that which we have. And the first problem that we have is we're like that bratty, spoiled teenager, because we're given it, we're given it, we're given it, we don't recognize it, we don't appreciate it, and learning to appreciate that which we're given takes a tremendous amount of work. We have to learn that rich doesn't have to mean richer than you. We have to learn to recognize that even if I've had it before, I still have it, and we have to learn to recognize that every good that we're going to have is going to have some bad mixed into it, but that doesn't take away from the good. The reality is, we, every one of us, enjoys tremendous, tremendous bracha. And if you're not quite sure I'm right, go to the hospital. Go to Sloan Kettering. Go visit any intensive care unit. And then walk out and say, wow, I could breathe on my own. I could walk freely. Every one of my joints move. No rheumatoid arthritis. No broken collarbone. This amazing thing called the body is a bracha that I'm given. But it's a strange thing, the human, until it's taken from us, until we're deprived of it, we don't even recognize it as a bracha, we don't even recognize that which we have. Now, I'd like to share with you a very, very key and important point. And this may come as a shock if you were brought up in a very strict yeshiva or Beis Yaakov. This may come as a very big shock. But when Hashem created the human, Hashem wants us to be happy in this world. This world is not the reason for creation. We're put here for a few short years to grow and accomplish, but our stay on the planet is supposed to be pleasant. And Hashem designed many, many things specifically so that the human should enjoy his stay on the planet. And yet, if you take the test of asking most people the key critical question, do you enjoy your life? Are you happy? Are you having a good time? You very rarely get the response of yes. Again, if you're not sure I'm right, take my little Musar test. Try it on some of your friends. Ask them that key lifestyle question. It's a sophisticated question. You may recognize it, but you may not understand the depth of it. The question is, how you doing? How you doing? How you doing? How you doing? And listen to the response. How you doing? Surviving. How you doing? Hanging in there. How you doing? Still alive. Now, my friends, if the doctor just told you have 6 months to live, and someone says to you, how you doing? And you say, surviving. That's appropriate. If the judge just decreed you're spending the next 50 years of your life behind bars, and someone says, how you doing? Still alive. But if you're living in the lap of freedom, luxuries and abundance at your beck and call, and you're living a life that for thousands of years man coveted, and your response to how you doing, surviving, something's wrong. Something doesn't add up. And what doesn't add up quite clearly is the world we live in doesn't appreciate the tremendous, tremendous wealth that we were given, that we enjoy. And we go about like that spoiled, bratty teenager. Of course this is given. Of course this is what's there. And therefore I have nothing. And of course we have no sense of recognizing the good. Hence there's no sense of appreciation to Hashem, because whatever, I ain't got nothing. And again, the first problem that we face is a spoiled brat teenager. But I believe there's a second cause. The second reason why it's difficult for us to be happy. And the second cause is something that the Chovetz Chovos explains to us. I once before mentioned something, and I'd like to expand on it. There is a very key distinction between pleasure and passion. Pleasure is the amount of enjoyment you get from the given activity. Passion is the desire that you have for that activity. Usually, people mix the two up. Let me give you a classic example of the distinction. If you find yourself on a desert island, and you have not eaten in 3 days, and under a palm tree, you find a brown paper bag, and you open the brown paper bag, and lo and behold, there is a dry, cracking peanut butter sandwich that's been sitting for 6 months in the sun. You will wolf that sandwich down with more passion, more desire than anything you've ever eaten in your life. But here's the question. How much pleasure did you derive? Oh, that peanut butter, wow! That acidic 6-month-old peanut butter that's been sitting in the sun just... And the dry bread has scratched my throat. Wow, is that one of the best meals I've ever had? I doubt there was very much pleasure. You see, a tremendous amount of desire, a lot of passion, but very little pleasure. And to be a sophisticated human being, you need to distinguish between the two. Pleasure is the amount of enjoyment you get from the activity. Passion is the pull, the desire, the drive. Oftentimes people think because they're deeply in drive mode, they're desirous of something, it must be the greatest pleasure of the world. Little do they recognize the fact that they're just very, very hungry, pulled by passions, controlled by desires, and is not that much pleasure in the given activity. But I'd like to extend this concept just a tad bit. I'd like to ask you, and I don't mean it to be as facetious as it sounds, what is the difference between French vanilla ice cream and crack cocaine? Now, you might think of a lot of differences between French vanilla ice cream and crack cocaine. I'd like to share with you one specific distinction. If you sit down to eat a bowl of French vanilla ice cream, you're doing it for one reason. You like the taste, you enjoy it. If you engage in smoking crack cocaine, you might well have done it initially the first time or two because you enjoyed it, but long ago did that stop to be the driving force? Long ago the driving force became an addiction. You see, it doesn't take very long at all for you being engaged in that activity to you become addicted to it. And I'd like to define for you an addiction. An addiction means it's not the pleasure that's driving you, it's the biological, the emotional, psychological need. It's not the pleasure. You see, French vanilla ice cream, you eat for the pleasure. I enjoy the taste. Crack cocaine, you pull to it, you need it, you have to have it, whether you enjoy it or not. And in fact, if you ask most drug addicts, most alcoholics, long ago it stopped being pleasurable. Long ago it stopped being fun, but they're driven, they need it, they have to have it. And I think understanding that is a key to understanding an interesting phenomenon. Most people that you will meet do not enjoy Olam Hazeh. And the reason that they don't enjoy this world is because they're addicted to this world. You see, French vanilla ice cream is a choice. But if you live your life on robotic mode, if you live your life more money, more material possessions, more honor, then what you're living is, you're living a life of an addict. You're addicted, you need it, you have to have it, and the addiction doesn't provide much pleasure. It's the guy who's driving on the West Side Highway, the $250,000 car, when he gets stopped in traffic the same way I do, asks the question, how much pleasure is there when you're sitting stuck on the West Side Highway next to the beat-up Rebbe's car? How much pleasure is there? The answer is, long ago it stopped being pleasure. You need it, you have to have it, you're into this world. What you define as good in this world is acquisition of material possessions. What you define as good and getting ahead in this world is a bigger house, a bigger position, more money, and you become long ago addicted to Olam Hazeh. The behaviorists began in the 1950s with an interesting experiment. They took rats, and they found what they call the pleasure center of the rat. And they hooked up a wire to the pleasure center of the rat, and they trained the rat that when it hit a lever, an electrical impulse would go through that brain, and it would get a jolt of pleasure. What they found very quickly was that the rats would stop eating. They would just hit the bar, hit the bar, hit the bar, until they died. The rats would literally kill themselves, stop eating, die from exhaustion, because all they would do would hit the bar, hit the bar, hit the bar, to get that stimulation, until they died in the cage. And that, my friends, was the first serious understanding of addiction, because it began as pleasure, and began as something that stimulated them and was enjoyable, but very quickly they needed it. It became a physiological need and became a tremendous drive, to the extent that it superseded every other drive, and these animals would kill themselves. There are many, many people that you will witness who literally kill themselves with their addictions to Olam Hazeh. And you may say to me, well, Rabbi, this is interesting, but it has nothing to do with me. I'm not into the big office with the view of the Hudson. I'm not into driving $250,000 cars. I'm a regular Jew. I'm not addicted. I'd like to share with you that many people are addicted without their being aware of it. And I'll share with you a couple of examples. If you know someone who watches television, I guarantee that person is addicted. And I'd like to share with you how I know that to be true. They've done study after study to analyze the happiness of people during different activities. A clever study that they did was they would put pagers on people, and these pagers would ring at different intervals, and the person would have to write down their happiness quotient when the pager went off, meaning we were somewhat happy, very happy, not so happy, kind of down, kind of depressed, and throughout the person's day, they would get a different rating based on what they were doing at that time. Were they happy, somewhat happy, not so happy, etc. Time after time, when these pages would go off on people watching television, the ratings were almost to the level of depression. Meaning to say, when you watch TV, if you ask yourself right now, are you happy? Not really, I'm just there. And time after time, when people were asked that question, the answer is, I'm just there. Yet most people, I don't know most, but apparently that's what the surveys say, many people in the United States of America watch TV 3 hours a day in an activity that's not like, wow, it's astounding, this is great, this is pleasure. 3 hours a day, and when they walk away, they're as empty as they started. And during the activity, they're absorbed, but it's not a pleasure absorption, they're there. But how many people really enjoy their watching, like, wow, this is great, this is fun, wow. Now, if you're not sure I'm right, or if you don't watch television, I'll share with you another couple of examples that I think may hit home. If you own a cell phone, you probably know the definition of a cell phone. It comes from the word jail cell. It's a shortened version of the word jail cell. Why? Because you are absolutely meshubad, enslaved to that phone. You must answer it no matter what, no matter when. It doesn't matter what you're doing, you must pick it up and you must answer it. And if you're a Gibor Chayil, you'll pick it up and look and decide whether to answer or not, but your children aren't safe from it, your family isn't safe, your wife isn't safe. No matter what you're doing, certainly the Beis Medrash and Tefillah B'Tzibur is not safe. And when you recognize that you're addicted to that, you begin to understand that you're not quite totally in control. If you're not sure I'm right yet, there's something in the world called Facebook and Twitter. Facebook and Twitter are the ultimate addictions. It wasn't enough that the cell phone rings all day. You have to have Twitter tell you what the schmooze.com is up to. The schmooze is in Baltimore. You get a Twitter. The schmooze is in Lakewood. You get a Twitter. Facebook will tell you it. And what's amazing is that people subscribe to this and get constant download all day long to get the information. And if you don't hear what I'm saying, here's the final kicker. If you have any connection to the internet, I personally guarantee you're wasting oodles of time. Here's a very simple observation. You go on the internet and you find yourself an hour later. And let's assume that you haven't gone to any sites that are improper. But you find yourself an hour later. What do you have to show for that hour? Now, most people will tell you, I don't have enough time in the day. Most people will say, sure, if I had another hour, I'd learn, I'd accomplish, I'd do wonderful things. But I'm so busy, I just don't have time. Do you know at this point, the greatest time-wasting feature in the workplace is the internet? Because people will spend between 2 and 3 hours of their day completely, utterly wasted. Why? Because they're addicted, they open an email, and they end up here, they end up there, and there's no great accomplishment. It's not a tremendous amount of pleasure. They're into it, they're gripped, and they're gone. And if you're not sure I'm right, I challenge you, do a time survey. Take a piece of paper, and every time you go on the internet, mark your beginning time, and then when you're done, mark your end time, and write down where you were between the beginning and the end. And I guarantee you'll find yourself wasting unbelievable amounts of time that bring you very little pleasure. I think this is a tremendous concept, understanding what it means to be addicted to this world. You see, addicted to this world means that you're not deriving pleasure. Hashem created us to be happy, and Hashem wants us to enjoy this world. But enjoying this world means you have to make conscious decisions. You have to learn to enjoy an apple, learn to enjoy an orange. You have to train yourself to enjoy a sunrise. You have to train yourself to be happy. But if you go about this life with this addicted mode, if you go about this life, whatever, just doing what everyone else does, what you're going to find is you have very little happiness in your life because you're not enjoying this world. Forget you're not accomplishing your purpose in creation. The world itself is bringing you very little joy, very little bit enjoyment, because you're a little bit like that crack cocaine addict. You're going through the motions, you're addicted, you're driven, but the pleasure is lacking. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from this Rashi. Rashi is telling us that we, the Jewish nation, have a debt of a karas atov to the Mitzrim, not for any of their intentions. They intended nothing for our good, but the reality is that we enjoyed. We enjoyed a place to live, we enjoyed a place that we inhabited, we had food, we had beds, therefore we owe them. Why? Because we have to train ourselves in recognizing the good. It's not for the Mitzri, and it's not because we have some debt to them. It's training ourselves to recognize that we were the recipients of good, and the only way a human being can enjoy this world is if they train themselves to recognize the riches that I have. As the Chovas Vavos tells us, the first reason why we rarely enjoy this world is because we're like that spoiled teenager, we've had everything, and we have to stop. We have to break away from it and recognize the richness of our generation, the riches of being alive, and the riches of everything that I have. But if you don't train yourself in it, you don't recognize it, you don't feel it, there's no sense of gratitude. Chovas Vavos tells us that the single greatest motivating force for a person to serve Hashem should be recognizing the good, should be a sense of unending gratitude. Hashem, how could I do anything to pay you back? If I spent my whole life, I couldn't pay you back 1/10,000th of that which I owe you. But the only way you could feel that is if you recognize how good you have it. And the first step in doing that is understanding how wealthy you are. And the way you do that is by understanding that rich doesn't mean richer than you. And Warren Buffett, by that definition, would be a very poor man. Rich means I enjoy, I have abundance. I have things, material possessions, physical pleasures. I have sights that I see, tastes that I enjoy. But you have to stop the busyness and train yourself to actually enjoy it. You have to learn how to take from this world. And you have to learn how to be happy. The second reason why it's very, very difficult for us human beings to enjoy this world is because we tend to get addicted. Much like that fellow who ingests crack cocaine, You're no longer seeking the pleasure. You're no longer doing that activity because you enjoy it. You're just by rote mechanically pursuing it. Most human beings live their lives by rote, addicted to this world. And anyone who you see who looks like he's pursuing pleasure is not pursuing pleasure, he's pursuing passion by a tremendous pull. We call that addicted. Whether it be various taivas, whether it be honor, whether it be money, whether it be whatever narcotic that sets him off, these people are addicted. And if you'd like to learn to enjoy your life, you have to learn to break away from these addictions. I'd like to close with one last thought. A fellow once asked the following question. He said, is it true that when Mashiach comes, we're all going to learn and daven, and that's all we're going to want to do? I said, yeah, that's correct. So then, who wants Mashiach? Because all the fun is gone. There's no fun. Ugh, who'd want Mashiach? Now, I want to share with you the answer to that dilemma this person has. Do you know why you should desperately hunger for Mashiach? Because when Mashiach comes, there'll be a brilliant light that shines on the world, and we human beings will be happy. Happy beyond belief. I'll be in balance. I'll be in sync. I'll know why Hashem created me. Sunrise will bring me such joy. Breathing the air will bring me such pleasure. The human being will actually be alive. Instead of this robotic, narcotic-driven robot, he'll live, enjoy this existence called the world. Because what we don't understand is that we really don't enjoy the tremendous pleasures that are here at our beck and call. At that stage, all of the addictions are cured. Meaning to say, you know why a person wants to daven? You know why a person wants to learn? Because he understands the real beauty of it. The addiction to hedonism, the addiction to this world is cured. Now a person has real drive to accomplish, to grow, and that brings a sense of enjoyment, satisfaction. The person has tremendous happiness. When he gets up in the morning, it's with a sense of wow, to be alive. When he goes to sleep at night, it's, I never have to go to sleep. I can't wait to get up the next morning. There's a sense of pleasure that a person has in his existence. Until Mashiach comes, a Jew can still train himself, can still grow. And the focus of all of this is because the more I train myself, certainly the more I enjoy this world, but the more I understand how much I owe Hashem, and ultimately the more of an Eved Hashem I am. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom, understanding, ability to put this into practice.